Welcome to Policy Chats, the official podcast of the School of Public Policy at the University of California, Riverside. I'm your host, Rachel Strassman. Join me and my classmates as we learn about potential policy solutions for today's biggest societal challenges. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome you all today to our panel and live podcast recording to discuss the Community Assistance, Recovery, and Empowerment, or CARE Act, and the intersection of mental health and criminal justice in California. This event is in collaboration with the UC Riverside School of Public Policy Presley Center for Crime and Justice Studies, which is dedicated to conducting rigorous empirical research related to criminal justice in the state of California and beyond. At this point, I'm now delighted to introduce you all to our amazing panelists for today's event. First, we have Jennifer Bender, a Deputy Public Defender at the Riverside County Public Defender's Office. Next, we have Stephanie Brooks Holliday, who is a senior behavioral scientist and clinical psychologist at RAND and a professor of policy analysis at the Party Rand Graduate School. Next, we have the Honorable Judge Magdalena Cohen. She previously served as a deputy public defender at the law offices of the Riverside County Public Defender since 2007. And in 2022, she was appointed to the bench as a judge for the Riverside County Superior Court in California. Next, we have Ms. Deborah Johnson. Ms. Johnson is a state-licensed clinical social worker and has been working for Riverside County for the past 44 years and is currently the Director of Innovation and Integration at the Riverside University Health System Behavioral Health. And finally, Eric Stouffer has been an attorney for 21 years, with the last 18 of those years as Deputy County Counsel with the County of Riverside, as well as the lead attorney for the County's CARE Act program. So with that, thank you all so much to our panelists for joining us today. Let's go ahead and get right into the questions. Could you please briefly explain your individual roles and how they play into the proceedings of the CARE Act process in Riverside County?
Since the mic is in front of me, I will start. I am the attorney for the county, so I represent the behavioral health department. I appear in all of the court hearings, make sure that we're compliant with all of our filings that are met required by the law, including petitions, responses, progress reports. And then I work closely with the public defender to make sure that behavioral health is providing the services that are statutorily required under the CARE Act, which includes outpatient treatment, medication, housing, any of the other services that may be needed to an individual.
So I'm Judge Magdalena Cohen, and I preside over our CARE Act court here in Riverside County. So any proceedings regarding CARE Act come to my department, and I am in charge of making decisions when people don't agree.
Though I don't have a role specific to CARE Act implementation in Riverside County, the research that I do is related to the intersection of psychology and law, and especially in California. And actually, RAND was recently selected to be the independent evaluator of the CARE Act across the state of California over the next 4 years. So though today doesn't represent my role as part of the evaluation team for that, we are looking forward to seeing how things will be implemented and the outcomes that the CARE Act achieves.
Good afternoon. I'm Deborah Johnson. And of course, behavioral health plays a major part in the CARE Act. From being appointed at the front end, we do all of the assessments. We provide the care agreements, the care plans. We look for housing, all of our behavioral health services. So I would say without us, there probably wouldn't be a CARE Act.
And good afternoon. I'm Jennifer Bender, and we represent the respondent, who is the participant in CARE. And it's our job to make sure that they understand their rights, they understand the proceedings. So we try to explain that in a way that they're going to be able to understand and a way that they're going to be able to find how this fits within their life, if that's something that they desire. And if they do not desire to be a part of the CARE Act, then we make sure that all of the criteria is met. And if it's not, then we fight against it.
And this is just one brief introduction to the amazing diverse perspectives we have today on this panel that we're so grateful for. And going into that, with all of these diverse backgrounds that you all have and different areas of expertise, what is the current state of mental health services in the state of California pre-CARE Act? And what are the most prominent successes and shortcomings?
I think one of the themes that we find when it comes to mental health services in California is that there are a lot of different options and a lot of different carve-out programs that are designed to meet the needs of particular populations that might be especially vulnerable. For example, I'm thinking about full service partnership, which especially targets the most vulnerable populations in our counties across California. But I think that even though there are a range of services available, some of the limiting factors are having enough providers to be able to offer services to everyone who might need services within a given county. There's a lot of variation from county to county with respect to the resources that are available, meaning that a lot of times it feels like access to mental health services can really be determined by the zip code that you live in. We find often that you will have people who reside in one county but conduct a lot of other aspects of their life in a different county, but those county lines can really dictate what access to services they have. We find that there can be a lot of transitions in care, and that transitions in care can be places where people are lost to follow-up and fall through the cracks. And we also find that knowing how to enter the system in the first place can be another limiting factor. It's a really complicated system, so even when the services do exist, having someone be able to find their way to the right open door can be a major hurdle.
Thank you so much for that introduction. How is the CARE Act different from other diversion programs, like you were mentioning, that have been historically implemented in Riverside County, or other existing laws that allow for people to be treated as an alternative to incarceration?
So in Riverside County, I think in 1994, the state implemented the Laura's Law Act, which is assisted outpatient treatment. It was an opt-in option for the counties, and Riverside did not opt into that program until the middle of the pandemic. And Ms. Bender and I worked together along with the courts to implement that program. And then along came the CARE Act. And there's a lot of similarities between the two. And it makes me wish we almost would have had the Laura's Law program going a lot sooner, because it kind of collects a lot of these people that fall within the parameters of the defined mental illness and attempts to give them the treatment that they need. So I think that they're valuable programs to getting people treatment, but unfortunately they also create these, I don't say silos, but they create pockets of support, and then there's on the other, the people that fall into the gray areas on either side still don't have that treatment. And so I think as we work to bring people into the programs, we also need, not we, but the state needs to look at how we can fill in those other gray areas to provide services to these people, not necessarily through the legal system, but just through services in general. So I think that the CARE Act lines up with Laura's Law really well in that, again, the services are similar. And it's designed to keep, I'll say designed, but the goal, at least from my perspective, is to get people into the Laura's Law program or the CARE Act and not put them into the more restrictive LPS conservatorship, which is where a lot of these people tend to decompensate into. So if we can stem them from getting into that, I think it lines up well with outpatient and non-intensive and non-hospitalizing type of treatment. So I think that the program is good to provide services in that area.
The main aspect of the CARE Act that we noticed as an office when we were reading the statute is that it allows individuals to bring a petition that normally would not be able to bring a loved one or a roommate, or even a first responder can bring someone they have a lot of contact with in front of the court to ask the court to order them to receive care. So historically, if you had a loved one who was experiencing severe mental illness and was untreated, you couldn't really, I don't want to say force them into treatment, but you really couldn't bring them in front of court without having a governmental agency make that decision and agree with you. So the CARE Act allows, if the person meets certain criteria, to have a family member bring their individual before a judge and ask that they be ordered to receive mental health treatment.
I think the other thing that I would add too is that there are also intentions that the CARE Act can prevent people from then entering the criminal justice system, because as was said, a lot of times people's symptoms do bring them into contact with the justice system, and then they get kind of wrapped up in this cycle of being in the system, being untreated, being back in the system. And there have been other efforts to try and address the needs of people with mental health conditions through the legal system, the criminal legal system, mental health courts, but those often require that people take a plea to be able to get the treatment that they need, and then they're under supervision of the court. more recent options have tried to move that further and further upstream. So more recently, things like mental health diversion, which allow people to complete a treatment program. And then if they do so successfully, their charges can be dismissed. But the concern that I always hear when speaking to providers and when speaking to clients of these programs is, why did I have to get into the legal system to begin with to access treatment? So I do think that there are also ways in which CARE Act is conceptualized as a way to prevent people from having to penetrate the criminal legal system before they're able to access services.
I think it's beautiful that you all mentioned that just as policy is constantly evolving and changing to try to fit the needs of the population best, the CARE Act is trying to take one step forward with that in terms of the intersection of mental health and the criminal legal system. So kind of bridging off of that, in many ways, the state has provided broad discretion to individual counties in terms of the CARE Act to make implementation decisions that serve to the best interests of their individual populations. So how does Riverside County specifically take this policy and implement it as a fully functioning program? And how do your respective organizations come together to collaborate on this implementation?
So for us here in Riverside County, we have a very supportive executive office in our county. And so he brought together all of the various departments at the onset to talk about the CARE Act and how we would implement it. And from there, we had weekly meetings, monthly meetings, you know, bi-monthly meetings all the way up until we actually implement it. And so all of the individuals sitting at this table, along with the fire department, the police, the sheriff, any county department, and the city, we also had meetings with the city to talk about how we were going to implement CARE Act. So I think it really was a collaboration, and, you know, I can't leave out the court because Judge Cohen and the court took a very active role in the implementation, from how we were going to develop forms to how we were going to communicate, how often we were going to be in court, how we're going to transport, all of what we could think of that would make it work in Riverside County.
Yeah, I want to say it was not an easy process. There was a lot of hand-wringing over how many petitions were going to be filed initially, how many people were going to be needed in behavioral health, in my office, in the public defender's office, in the court, to process. I mean, this is just from the legal sense, how we were going to process all of the paperwork. And then once we got the clients into court, how we were going to handle all those hearings. But we all worked together really well, and I'm appreciative of that fact that, you know, we all took an active role in this process, because I've heard from other counties that it doesn't maybe work as smoothly as it does here in Riverside. And I think that that's a benefit to our county, is that we, I don't say we're all on the same page, but we all have an idea of how this program can be beneficial to an average individual when they get enrolled in the program. And so we all want not only the program to succeed, but all these individuals that have petitions filed succeed. So I think that the implementation process so far has been a success. And we've worked through the kinks, and, you know, it is a brand new program with a very vague statute at times on how we proceed. So we've been working our way through all of that, but I'm appreciative of the fact that we've been able to all work together as we do that.
And if I may ask, you both brought up the immense amount of collaboration required to make this policy happen. Is that typical of most policies, or is that something that truly the CARE Act was able to bring all these departments together to help achieve such a groundbreaking policy?
I can compare it to the Laura's Law process, which was basically myself and Ms. Bender doing that. And to some extent, behavioral health. But a lot of it was the figuring out how to get documents filed with the court and where the hearings were going to be and that sort of thing. But this was a more laborious process because we were one of the first counties to enroll in the program, or we were one of the first seven. And because of the scrutiny that we knew was going to be coming, we wanted to make sure we were doing as much as possible to ensure its success. So I think that that's why we all did work together and why we brought everybody in. As Ms. Johnson said, we had monthly, if not weekly, meetings mm-hmm. with everybody, from the executive office of the board all the way down to, you know, me and Ms. Bender, who are going to be the attorneys in court. And so I think that that was very key to the process, making sure that we implemented everything properly and that, or at least tried to implement everything properly as we work through this. So,
Thank you. So looking further into how Riverside County is tackling this policy specifically, this policy calls for a lot of county resources, whether it be behavioral health workers, which are currently experiencing a nationwide shortage, housing or beds. How is Riverside County working to address resource limitations, and what support does the state provide in reducing the burden on counties?
So I'll start.
I think you might be the only one. Yeah.
I guess for behavior health, because we were in cohort one, our motto was we're going to do whatever it takes to make it work. And so prior to the CARE Act, we were already looking at our housing situation. So we have board and cares, we have augmented board and cares, we have contracts with a lot of facilities and skilled nursing facilities. And so we just decided that we were going to take the resources that we have, which are very limited, and try to identify the needs of the individual in the CARE Act. And we've been very fortunate to be able to get housing, whatever it is, for those individuals who are currently in our CARE Act. And so we've just committed to making it work. You know, I won't comment very much with respect to the state other than we do apply for all grants, whether they're federal or state grants, and we've been able to build a 76-bed augmented board and care in Palm Springs. We have an 80-bed augmented board and care coming up in Riverside real soon. So we have been able to get resources to assist us.
Specifically, the Public Defender's Office has been fortunate enough to receive a fairly sizable grant for supporting our implementation of the CARE Act. So we're grateful to the State Bar for that. And I'm sorry to Eric, who has not received the same funding yet. But we see the benefit in implementing the CARE Act, because if we don't provide assistance to people in an outpatient voluntary setting, we know we're going to see them in an inpatient involuntary setting, either under an LPS conservatorship, or we're going to see them facing serious criminal charges. And when they go to face serious criminal charges, that often leads to long-term incarceration, and there's really no mental health treatment that's suitable in those settings. So we are hopeful that the CARE Act is going to help to divert some of those people from those more restrictive treatments or lack of treatment, depending on where they land. And so we've been fortunate enough to have support in order to help our implementation of that.
As new technologies continue to emerge, the transportation sector only keeps getting more advanced. Now, more than ever, it is so important to evaluate our transportation policy. On Thursday, May 2nd, the UCR School of Public Policy will be hosting an in-person and virtual community seminar featuring Hassan Akrada, the former CEO of the San Diego Association of Governments, where he will discuss the complexities and the future of transportation policy. To register and for more information, please check out the link in our show notes.
Thank you so much. So a lot of opponents of the CARE Act worry about the implications the CARE Act has on civil liberties. And I know Ms. Bender and I, we've talked about this before. What are your thoughts on this with respect to implementation in Riverside County? And what protections are in place within the CARE Act to ensure that their care is in the best interest of the individual?
Well, for starters, just the fact that they are appointed an attorney in a civil setting, because this isn't a criminal setting. In any criminal proceeding under the Sixth Amendment, you're entitled to legal representation, which is normally what our office does. However, under the CARE Act, the statute specifically calls for an attorney to be appointed to represent the respondents to ensure that their rights are protected and that they understand the proceedings and all the rights. As I said earlier, there are lots of criticisms of the CARE Act in that they say people who are forced into treatment don't have success long term. However, uniquely in our office, we see what happens when they are given no treatment at all. They end up incarcerated or they end up in long-term conservatorships. So as an office, we are definitely willing to give it a try. But of course, if our client does not want to be a part of the CARE Act, then we make sure that we can do everything that we can legally to prevent them from being forced into the CARE Act.
And kind of on that note, I know Ms. Bender mentioned earlier, this is kind of a voluntary program. Someone can file a petition, bringing someone in front of the court, and the person can say, I don't want to be treated. Now, that doesn't mean that it just goes away, but at some level, we can't force anything on these individuals. I can't file a petition to ask that the court force them to take medication. I can't file a petition to order them to be forced into a specific locked facility. I don't even think I could file a petition to force them to take a specific housing situation that they don't want, even if it's a board and care. We work together collaboratively to try and, I don't say coerce them, that's not the word I'm using, but kind of provide them with direction that this might be in their best interest to go to a facility or to take their medication or to go to their treatment on a weekly or biweekly or monthly basis. But it's all voluntary. And so in terms of impacting their rights, you know, as someone who has to defend the county when there's a civil rights violation, our office would look at it and say, well, it's all voluntary. So there is some civil rights issues at play. The positive in this is that a lot of it is voluntary. And so it can be looked at as, you know, not a complete taking away of someone's civil rights, as more so on the LPS side of things, where they become a conservatee and the conservator can tell them where to go, or they end up in jail where the sheriff and the district attorney and the court can tell them when and where they get to get out of jail. So I think that in that sense, it's a program that hopefully will empower these people to say, like, oh, I can do this on my own, and no one's going to tell me what to do. I'm making the decision to do it, which I think also benefits people in the long run to work on their executive functioning and their successful treatment going forward.
That I've really encouraged everybody to focus on is who were our respondents or our participants before they became their mental health diagnosis. So often in contact with all government agencies, people become their diagnosis. And the thought that I think we all share is that if we can reconnect them to something they were passionate about, something they loved before they became schizophrenia, before they became psychosis not otherwise specified, there's a chance that in reconnecting with that person, they may engage and stay in long-term treatment. And that's what everybody sitting at the table's hope is that we can get people out of the cycle that we see over and over, where they end up hospitalized or they end up incarcerated, and then we start over.
I think you all bring up an amazing aspect of the CARE Act, which is something that Ms. Bender previously told me about being a public defender, that at the end of the day, their goal is not to serve in the best interest necessarily, but in the interest of the individual. And they're there to protect the individual, whichever decision that they make. I think that truly helps the CARE Act protect these individuals further. So moving forward, looking into the future a bit, how can this policy serve as a guide for future mental health and criminal justice programs and interventions in Riverside County?
CARE Act is not part of our criminal court system at all. It is a civil proceeding. We handle it in our probate division. There is no direct crossover with criminalization and incarceration. We do get referrals through some very narrow means left in the statute of incompetent people who have misdemeanors. So we get referrals potentially from the criminal court, but it is not part of the criminal justice system. It is an independent civil court intended to connect people with treatment. As to the larger policy concerns, I'll defer to Dr. Brooks.
The researcher in me has to emphasize that I think before something like this can serve as a model to any type of future policy, there is a need to understand how and if it works. So I do think that, and I'm not just saying this because we're involved in the evaluation, but I do think that the evaluation is going to be a really critical part of this over the next few years, because understanding how it's being implemented, what the variation looks like from county to county, if there are practices that are emerging as kind of the optimal way to implement, understanding what impact it is having on the short term. Are people actually connecting with treatment? Are they staying with treatment? Are they getting housed? Are they staying housed? Is it really helping with some of those longer term things that we're hoping it will? Is it preventing incarceration? Is it preventing future hospitalizations that maybe could be avoided? Is it preventing conservatorships? I think these are all going to be really important parts of the questions before we know what the effective components are of the policy and what aren't. That said, I do think that there are ways in which the policy could serve as a model if we find that there are components of it that are effective or that the gestalt of it is effective. I think one of the things that people don't always know about CARE Act is that it does have pretty limited eligibility criteria. For example, even the diagnoses themselves that are eligible for CARE Act are limited. Schizophrenia and other psychotic spectrum disorders, that leaves a whole host of different diagnoses that are not included in CARE Act. So I think that if we find that there are parts of it that are effective or that it as a whole is effective, then it perhaps gives us a clue as to how we might be able to address the needs of a wider population of folks.
Kind of branching off of that, if there's one thing that you all could leave the audience with today about the CARE Act that might be a misunderstanding or just an important aspect of the CARE Act, what would each of you say it would be?
There is no forced medication. No one can force participants or respondents to take medication. There was a headline out of Orange County, families have been really frustrated with that aspect. And there is, we talk a lot about how this is the core. It's all about carrots and no sticks. And so it's about finding ways to incentivize or encourage participation. It's not about forcing medication or treatment on people.
Yeah, I'm going to echo that. It's all voluntariness, right? We cannot force anything, even placement. I can't force locked placement. It's all voluntary. So we have had, in Riverside, we've had several people say, well, you can't force my loved one to do that. Sorry, no, I can't. And that's a tough thing to tell someone who's there with their loved one who is clearly mentally ill, clearly needs services, clearly doesn't want those services. I can't do anything for them if they're not willing to go after that carrot that we don't have a stick to whap them on as they're not complying, right? We just have to kind of hold that out in front of them and hope that they follow along, and some do, some don't. And so we're working through that process as we move along. So the voluntariness and the no forced medication is the big one. Hopefully, if any of you have anybody that's involved or wants to be involved, that's a big one. So I would stress that.
Just secondarily, don't let that prevent you from filing petitions. If you have loved ones that you believe belong in the program, file your petitions, because certainly the people sitting at this table and the teams behind them will do what they can to help people get into services. That is the purpose of what we're doing.
The other thing is, along with there's no forced medication, there's also no forced facilities. So this is all outpatient treatment. This is going to your local clinic on a regular basis, meeting with a therapist, meeting with a psychiatrist. And as anyone knows, when they go to the doctor and they don't like their doctor, mental health treatment is about finding the right fit. And so we're all about being flexible in our court and trying to work with the person. But the reality is families are out there and they are hurting and they are looking for solutions. And this is one solution that the state is trying to provide. And there are always going to be critics to it, but you know, we're doing our best to encourage people to participate. And when they don't want to participate, then we work through other options with them.
And then you all have briefly mentioned kind of some misconceptions about the CARE Act. Is this common with policies to have a lot of misconceptions, because policy is a very, I think, difficult thing for the average person to understand? Or is this something unique to the CARE Act?
I can't really talk about policies per se, because I'm the attorney, so I deal with the law and the statutes. But there is misconceptions with the statutes just as often as there is with policy. We see this with the LPS Act. I see this with, I represent the Public Guardian, who is the county entity that is the conservator for individuals, both mentally ill individuals and either elder or dependent adults who need help providing for their care, ongoing care on a daily basis. And the statutes are sometimes not very clear on what you can and can't do. And especially in CARE Act, we've run into some problems with understanding. So I would say that the answer to your question is probably yes, that there's a lot of misconceptions about policy, because even the statutes that are the result of that policy have some misconceptions in them as well. But
a lot of misconception in policy. I don't think it's necessarily unique to CARE Act, but I do think that the complexity of CARE Act and the number of stakeholder groups and agencies that are involved and the fact that some of this comes from the state level but then gets implemented at the county level, I think all of those types of factors do create a lot of additional flexibility with this policy and with a lot of the mental health and criminal legal policies that come down in California.
Social injustice, health disparities, climate change. Are you interested in solving pressing challenges like these currently facing our region and the world? Then consider joining the next cohort of future policy leaders like me by applying for the UCR Master of Public Policy program. Learn more at mpp.ucr.edu. You can also find the link in our show notes.
Thank you all so much for providing your insights to our questions. At this point, we're going to go ahead and move on to questions submitted by our live audience members. So Dr. Brooks Holliday had previously mentioned the opportunity to do some program policy evaluation. So this question would be to the county representatives. Has the county anticipated, as we roll out a brand new program, that there's an opportunity to document the implementation stage and any missteps? And is this information being collected for evaluation in the future?
We actually have a contract with a company that's working with us to look at how we implemented CareCord and is documenting the steps. We're always interested in learning from it, but we're so new into it. And so we get a lot of questions about how is it going. It's very difficult to evaluate how it's going when it's so new. But we do have a contractor that we're working with through USC to assist us with documenting and looking at the end, how well we're doing.
This is all very interesting. Thank you all so much. I was just wondering if you could elaborate a little more on the pathway to care court. It sounds like from what I can tell, it's individual family members that might petition the court, but obviously there are lots of nonprofits, behavioral health, other agencies that are working and coming into contact with this population. So would they be able to circumvent the care court? If you could please discuss a little more on how this process specifically works.
Petitions can be filed by a laundry list of people. You know, behavioral health can file their own petitions for sure, which can come from their own internal data. And we also can get referrals from the criminal court. And I don't know if that shows up in the statutes, but under an individual who is incompetent to stand trial and charged with a misdemeanor, rather than treat them for the incompetency and try and restore them to competency, the statutes have been changed to just refer them out to various programs. And one of those that they can refer them directly to is the Care Court program. So we do get referrals from the criminal court as well, in addition to the laundry list of people that can file under the statute.
The CARE Act is captured in a series of statutes in the Welfare and Institutions Code. The first one I pulled was 5972, but 5974 contains a list of everyone that can file. So anyone with whom the respondent resides, a spouse, parent, sibling, child, grandparent, or any individual who stands in loco parentis to the respondent, the director of the hospital, the director of a public or charitable organization, any licensed behavioral health professional or their designee, a first responder, including a peace officer, firefighter, paramedic, emergency medical technician or mobile crisis response worker, the public guardian or public conservator, the director of the county behavioral health, the director of the county adult protective services, the director of the California Indian Health Services Program, or a judge in the tribal courts in California, or the respondent can file a petition for themselves. So that's the entirety of the list of people who can file. And then from there, a petition gets filed under statute. It then gets referred to behavioral health for a report. The report's then evaluated for whether or not it meets that prima facie criteria. And if it does, an initial hearing is set. And that's all laid out in very detailed statutory language.
I just want to add, for those who live in the dorms, roommates are also under the statute.
So I understand that the petition process can be quite complicated. If there were to be a family member or a friend that wants to petition the court, is there a specific department that's able to assist these individuals when they're filing all of the paperwork?
All the forms for CARE Acts are support forms. There's forms for everything, and you can walk them into any self-help center in the Riverside courts, and they can walk you through the process. Our self-help did a lot of work ahead of time to be prepared to deal with a population that they sometimes deal with and sometimes don't, as well as to be familiar with how the forms need to be completed so that they can assist in that respect.
This is all such amazing information. As a follow-up, what was the size of the population in Riverside that you thought might be taking advantage of the CARE Act? And then also, because the program's been in existence for about 5 or so months, how many petitions have been filed to date? And finally, of the petitions that have been filed, where there has been some reasonable resolution, what percentage of the respondents have accepted voluntary care versus opted out and decided not to continue in the program?
It was a long time when I kept that number of how many petitions we were at right at the front of my head. So I do not have that today. I believe we're at approximately, I want to say 40-ish?
38, I think.
38, I'm being told. I think we're far too early to address percentages and the other specific things that you're asking about. I'm going to defer to Ms. Johnson on that anticipation. She was involved, I think, in more of those meetings than I was.
So for Riverside County and Behavioral Health, we staff based on 120 for around 6 months. We did that to make sure that we had appropriate staff to do the evaluations. We're not near that, but I think it's way too new. And to answer your question about how many opted in for voluntary treatment, we have a phone line that we call the CARES line, and we receive thousands of calls on a daily basis. And I can tell you that the staff are keeping the stats, and we have more individuals going into voluntary outpatient treatment. We have a whole host of outpatient services, and it gives us an opportunity, actually, to encourage and to walk people through our outpatient system of care. It can be very convoluted, but we have trained staff to be able to do that.
Kind of looking at the CARE Act from a different lens, in terms of hospitalization, because some people can really struggle to succeed when hospitalized and going through mental health struggles, how can CARE help people if they do have to be hospitalized?
So for our department, an individual who is hospitalized, we do a treatment plan, what we call a discharge plan. We have full service partnership programs where the individual is attached to a case manager who does whatever it takes to keep the person stable. Appointments are made prior to the person being discharged. And of course, you know, for the inpatient staff, they're looking at where the individual is going to end up, whether it's going to be home with family members, whether it's going to be in a care facility. So I think, you know, we do what we can to make sure that coming out of an inpatient setting, that person is prioritized, you know, to receive the services that they need, including medication. We have a whole host of outpatient clinics from the city of Riverside all the way to Blythe. And so really, we try to work with that individual to provide them with the best of their needs. And it's individualized. It's whatever it's going to take, you know, to keep that person stable in the community.
Thank you so much. Our next question is for Mr. Stouffer. You talked about this being a program that relies a lot on carrots and how there is a lack of sticks. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what incentives or mechanisms you're finding are working, and maybe what sort of carrots you're dangling. And then also for Dr. Brooks Holliday, is there currently any research maybe you can highlight with respect to incentives and nudges that are effective for these programs?
So, no, I can't really say that we're dangling certain carrots. I think it's a lot of individualized services that we offer. I think Ms. Bender is probably, I don't say she needs to answer the question, but she is the one that interfaces most with the individuals once we get them to court. We do have behavioral health staff that interfaces with them outside of the court setting. But the idea is to, at least from my perspective, show them that you're getting services, you're getting your medication, that we'll provide you with a phone, we can get housing for you. I think those are the carrots that we provide. And I think ultimately the goal would be to tell them, you don't want to be back in jail. You don't want to be 5150 and put in the inpatient setting in the hospital. Not that they're necessarily going to end up that way, but if that's something that they recently came out of, or they have a very significant history of going in and out of those settings, this program can be offered as an alternative to that to kind of keep them hopefully stabilized enough that they don't end up in those settings. So those are the kind of the carrots, if you will, that we're offering. But they're not really, hey, here's money, here's food. I mean, those are part of the services that might be offered in some way, but not directly handing them cash or something like that.
The research on this is not that well developed at this point. I know what I hear in some of the more qualitative research that I do, again, both with clients of programs and providers from programs, is that helping people to meet some of their basic needs is a good way to keep people in programs, not necessarily because it's an incentive, but because it's really hard to focus on meaningful mental health treatment when you're also worrying about where you're sleeping that night, where your next meal is coming from, what your family is doing, if you have children, who is taking care of your children. So being able to provide those types of wraparound supports through other ancillary services can be really important. I think the other thing that I hear a lot is that what makes a difference is understanding that the road to stability is not a smoothly paved one, and that you have to be prepared for recovery to look discontinuous, and for there to be lapses, and for there to be falls, and for there to be things that don't go exactly as planned, and that the more grace that people can be given within the confines of a program, the better it can be, because it's not always going to stick the first time around, but it might stick the second time around or the third time around, and that being able to provide people those types of chances or see if tweaks are needed when those types of lapses happen can be another thing that eventually leads to long-term success for people.
Yeah, in behavioral health, we do have a no wrong door. However they get into department, we're going to try to provide services for them. The other point that I wanted to make is it is very important to communicate with the consumer, and you know, many times they know what they want and what they don't want. And I think in terms of training our staff to really pay attention, because sometimes what they want is what they need and is what's going to make them stable. But however they get to us, it's the same as I mentioned with our CARES line. They'll call on their CARES line and think that they want A, but they really want B, and so we're going to work with them to get them the services that they want.
In terms of planning for the program, whether at the state or the county level, how would you define success?
Well, I can speak for the fact that the statute actually does outline a set of potential indicators of success that will be tracked as part of the independent evaluation and are also related to some of the data elements that the state is requiring counties to collect and submit. And so some of them are things that have already been mentioned: incarceration, conservatorship, hospitalization, initiation of other types of behavioral health treatment. One of the things that we're really going to keep an eye to, though, as we're designing the evaluation, is knowing that those types of numbers don't always tell the full story of success. Something that's really important to us as we think about the evaluation is making sure we're taking into consideration the perspective of a lot of different types of stakeholder groups when we're coming up with our metrics for quote-unquote success, which means talking to the people who are implementing the program, talking to the providers, talking to the court staff, talking to people who have lived experience, how they would define success, talking to people who oppose CARE Act and understanding what their concerns are and what they would be looking for in terms of signs of success, and then being able to design an evaluation that assesses those. I know that one thing that is also really important to that is knowing that you can't use any single source of information to say whether or not a program like this is successful. Data submitted by programs themselves and by counties is one really important source of information. We'll be able to look at some administrative data sources that the state maintains, which provides a little bit more of a quote-unquote objective source of information that's being tracked. We want to survey participants, respondents themselves. We want to talk to them. There are a lot of different ways that we're going to have to get at measuring success, which is why I'm giving such a long answer to what seems like it could be a really straightforward question as to what measurement of success looks like.
from a public defender's standpoint, a measure of success for us would be no new case numbers. So that's always a measure of success for us.
Yeah, I was going to say something along the same lines of, it'd be great if I had zero petitions to respond to, because that means these people are being treated elsewhere, not within the court system and not the program. The end goal would be no LPS, no mental health diversion. I mean, all of these things, all of these different categories that you hear would be success. But on an individual level, I mean, just getting someone into the program can be determined as a success to some extent if they're really resistant for a long time. So there are a lot of different ways you can couch the term or define the term success. But I think from a numbers standpoint, I don't consider any time we do anything a success. And I just think that we're getting people the help that they need. And I think that in and of itself is success on our end.
I will say also that I think another important component of success is making sure that success is equitably received or experienced by people, that it's not just certain groups who are maybe the easiest to get into treatment who are the ones succeeding, or particular racial or ethnic groups that are having the most markers of success, but rather that we're seeing that these types of indicators look similar across a lot of different types of groups. Because if you have a group that's succeeding, but they all share a lot of similar characteristics, and then you have another group that's not succeeding, I don't know that we can call that success. We can call it success for a group, but does it mean that the program is fully succeeding? I think it means that there are opportunities to fill in gaps.
Some have been saying that the process itself for the CARE Act seems difficult. For example, the documentation reads as legal paperwork, which is understandably necessary for the process, but can be difficult for a family that isn't aware of the resources that can help them go through with filing. So with that being said, what resources are available for people who are indeed filing?
And I think we've touched on a couple of the big pieces. From a behavioral health standpoint, that's the CARE line. It's an 800 number. You dial it. Someone will help you connect with services. From the court perspective, that's the self-help department. If you walk into the clerk's department, they can direct you to self-help, and then self-help can help you navigate the paperwork, if that's what you're asking. So those are the things that the court and behavioral health have in place to try to make the access to care services more accessible to general public.
Also, the courts have put together two fairly comprehensive information sheets, one for petitioners and one for respondents. And those are both available on the Superior Court website under the CARE forms. And it gives a very good general overview of what those two groups need to know about CARE Act.
Thank you so much. And with that, we're going to go ahead and move on to our final live audience question. So it sounds like you've all done a great job preparing with beds and residential locations. So given that we know that stable housing is so important for outpatient treatment, and being that this is a new program and California by some estimates has 30% of the nation's unhoused population, so as this becomes more implemented, do you anticipate problems with finding housing for folks so they can continue to receive treatment or support in some way? And what happens when there is a housing shortage? What do you anticipate will happen? And are there plans in place as it becomes more common and people are increasingly becoming aware about this resource?
So in Riverside County, we have behavioral health housing program, as well as the county has a housing program, and we work collectively together. So we're always planning and brainstorming about what's next. And so, you know, there's no wood here, so I can't knock. But so far, we've been able to house, the individuals in care court. Looking forward, we don't know what the future's going to hold. We know that we have a shortage now, but we've been very, very fortunate, you know, to brainstorm and to come up with, you know, some housing type. So we have emergency housing. As I mentioned before, we go after every grant that we can find to build long-term housing. We have arrangements with private entities who build apartment complexes, and then they'll give us 10 or 15 or 20, and that's throughout Riverside County. And so we will continue to do that and hope that the state and the federal government will come through with us down the line. But for now, we feel very fortunate that we have been able to house those that have wanted to be housed. Not everybody wants it, but for those who we wanted, we've been able to come through.
I will say one thing that Ms. Johnson points out is how there's already a housing shortage, and you hear that in any county. I think Riverside County, it's a little bit, I don't say more problematic, but Riverside County is continually growing in terms of population, whereas Orange County is almost fully built out. So the population isn't going to increase as dramatically in a county like Orange County as it is here in Riverside County. So to use the LPS conservatorships, which I started doing in 2005, those numbers have increased considerably from when I started. And I think that I don't say concern, but that's something that needs to be addressed this is a policy question, which I know I said I wouldn't answer policy questions. It's a policy thing that has to be looked at, is how are we going to plan for those housing issues, not only in Care Corps, but in any other program that the state wants to have the counties look at, and even with LPS. And I think that that's not a problem, but something that Riverside is not unique to, but it's certainly more unique than some of the other larger counties in California.
With that, I would like to say thank you all to everyone for coming here, for asking your questions, and especially to our panelists. The CARE Act is such a groundbreaking policy, and I think it's amazing that we get to hear from all of these diverse perspectives about the true impact of it, whether it is the fact that it's doing its best to keep people that need mental health services out of the criminal legal system and keeping it in civil courts, or whether it's that there are public defenders making sure that these people get their interests represented, or even Dr. Brooks Holliday, who talks about evaluation and ensuring that this policy works. All of you and your respective perspectives are truly coming together in what makes this policy so amazing. So I would like to thank you all for coming here, the panelists. Additionally, please be sure to check out the Presley Center for Crime and Justice Studies at presleycenter.ucr.edu, of which we are so grateful to collaborate with for this event. So with that, thank you again so much for joining us, and I wish you all an amazing rest of your day.
This podcast is a production of the UC Riverside School of Public Policy, and our theme music was produced by C. Code A. For the latest updates on the School of Public Policy, be sure to check us out at UCR_SPP on Instagram. Or for more episodes and content, visit our YouTube channel. I'm Rachel Strassman. Till next time.